Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Madeline Reynolds.
Lisa A. Phillips' new book, First Love, Guiding Teens Through Relationships and Heartbreak, chronicles the challenges that adolescents face as they navigate the world of love and the challenges that adults face as they try to provide support and guidance from the perspective of a mother, professor, and award-winning journalist. Phillips brings to light how relationships that teens have today are much different from what their parents' generations experienced, such as social media, the heavy reliance of technology, higher rates of anxiety and depression, the rise of young people identifying as LGBTQ+, and constant consciousness. She provides insights and strategies from experts and teens themselves on ways that parents and adults in general can help younger people cope with the enduring issues of love and heartbreak. Lisa A. Phillips is the author of Unrequited, The Thinking Woman's Guide to Romantic Obsession, and Public Radio Behind the Voices. She has written for the New York Times, Washington Post, Psychology Today, Cosmopolitan, Salon, and more about relationships, mental health, and teens. She teaches journalism and the popular seminar Love and Heartbreak at the State University of New York at New Paltz. The new book is First Love, Guiding Teens Through Relationships and Heartbreak. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
My first question to you is that in your introduction of the book, you delve into your personal experience navigating your daughter's romantic relationships. Was that the inspiration for the book? And if so, could you just elaborate on that?
That was absolutely the inspiration for the book. When my daughter was 13, she started dating a neighbor boy. And at that point in time, I was, still am, a journalist who covers mental health and relationships. I like to say that I am on the love and heartbreak beat. And I think the combination of my brain being immersed in all this stuff so much of the time and my own memories of going through relationships as a teen and young adult, and then the protectiveness that I felt as a mother watching her increasingly independent daughter move into this particular terrain, all that added up to a kind of, to put it in a quick phrase, freak out. I was very nervous. I was very vigilant. I felt protective of her in a way I hadn't since she was a small child. But I couldn't be the same parent I was when she was a baby. I had to let her grow up. And I sought advice from books and articles and the way that I normally do. And what I saw was a landscape that really emphasized sex education and consent, both amazing things to emphasize, but not a whole lot out there on the emotional side of first relationships. And that was the side that I decided to explore as a journalist and a mom and a professor to write essentially the guide that I wished I'd had at that point in time.
In your book, you include many testimonials from many different people with their different experiences with love. Is there one that particularly stood out with you or really like stayed with you? And how did you find all these people to include in your book?
I'll first tackle the question of how I found people. I tapped into the network of young people in my life. I hired student assistants from SUNY New Paltz, where I teach, and especially from my Love and Heartbreak course alumni. And they helped me network to young people. I tended to stick with people who were very recently in high school, so meaning 18 to 25 or so that they were adults and I didn't have to deal with sort of the consent issue that I might have to deal with minors, getting their parents' permission and so forth. And they had a little bit of that wisdom of the retrospective experience. You know, they could speak with some perspective about what they went through in middle school and high school, and in some cases were still going through in college. So I did that, and I had a survey that I passed around to kind of screen people and seek a wide range of stories. So one of the stories that really sticks in my mind is probably one of the more unusual stories in the book, and that's the story of Athira and John. They are a couple whose parents both grew up in the same state in India, Kerala. They were both Catholic Indians, which is that's a common population in Kerala, India. And they met each other at church outside of Chicago and at a church meant for the Catholic Indian diaspora community there. And on paper, everything looked great for them to be a couple. They had similar ambitions. They're both very smart, wanted to go to med school, all these great things. But their parents disapproved because of the really important aspect of their culture, which is that parents and family and community play a role in the dating process, in the husband and wife selection process, what we, I think, more commonly known as arranged marriage, though that process is a little more complicated and there is a bit more agency for young people in it now. And their parents didn't think they were ready, so they went kind of underground. They conducted a relationship in secret for 7 years, went to graduate school together, lived together, all under the radar of their parents, until, as I was reporting this story, they finally had to come out and say, "Hey, remember you told us never to see each other and not to date? Actually, we've been in each other's lives all this time." Ultimately, it's a happy story because they're married now and both sets of parents approve wholeheartedly. But what they went through really illuminates the circumstance that is unfamiliar to much of us, which is what happens when relationships are about a more collectivist view of the world, as opposed to an individualist view of the world, that you always have your own choice and love. So I really treasure their story and the way they let me into their lives, including their parents, ultimately, for what it teaches us about the different ways young people go through relationships.
Crushes. We've all had them or have them. It's a universal experience. In the book, you provide, different types of crushes that we can experience. So what are those? And ultimately, what do you think we learn from having a crush?
A crush, in its most basic definition, is being really attracted to someone, and typically assuming that you don't know yet if they're going to requite your feelings. So, a crush is something I wanted to examine because it is the quintessential experience of being a teen. We know that in our culture, this is spotlit as a experience to celebrate in a kind of wistful way, like it's going to be both awesome, a reason to put on lipstick, and also potentially very painful if the person doesn't like you back. Cue, countless Taylor Swift songs for, at this point. But when you dig into crushes, what you find is they are, as one of the researchers I spoke with called them, true dress rehearsals for relationships, where young people go through a lot of the emotions and the reflections and the sort of navigating of, like, okay, what do I do here? The decisions that you need to make about whether to express your emotions, how to regulate strong emotions, and so forth in the crush phase of a relationship or of just life, because sometimes they don't result, often they don't result in a relationship. And that these are true love life learning lessons that can really give us valuable information about what we want in relationships, what we want from ourselves. I discovered that there's such a thing as an identity crush, where you crush on someone because they have qualities that you admire and want for yourself. And that can be really important because you're getting information about the kind of person you want to be. It's not necessarily always the kind of person you want to date. So crushes are huge. I'm a big defender of them, and they are a true milestone in the beginning of a person's love life.
The book is First Love: Guiding Teens Through Relationships and Heartbreak by Lisa A. Phillips and published by Roman and Littlefield. So I believe we as a human species all experience some same facets when it comes to romance and love to a certain degree. We share a commonality. But however, in your book, you make many points about how younger generations, like Gen Z, for example, have different experiences from maybe their parents. So what are those differences that young people are now navigating in when it comes to love and the effects of that?
This is truly the raison d'être of this book. If teens were having relationships in the same way their parents were, we would know more about them because we know what we went through. But in fact, this generation of young people really experience things in a very different way on many levels. Some things, of course, are the same. Crushes, those feelings are the same. That people have relationships are the same. They have to deal with the question of, do I have my sexual debut with this person? That's the same. But then there are things like, the obvious one is social media. Very, very different. We are in a world where relationships don't have the same boundaries because we're always, in a sense, carrying them in our pocket, which is pretty intense. And I actually, when I researched it, my heart always sank when I thought about that kind of steady pressure. There are other things that are very different. Young people are much less likely to be straight. One out of four high schoolers now says that they are something other than straight. And so that's changing the nature of relationships. Another aspect is that this is a very mental health literate generation. And that means some things that are very difficult, as we know, as the Surgeon General called it, we're in a kind of epidemic, a mental health crisis among young people. And that affects how they are in relationships and whether they have relationships, which links to one more point, which is that young people are also starting all of these things later. They're starting to date and have serious relationships later. They are having their sexual debut later. And that goes along with a host of ways that they are going through those milestones of teen and young adult life much later.
You also, in your book, make sure to showcase that your children should want to be open with you as a parent to have conversations about love, relationships, and intimacy. So how should parents make sure that their connection and their communication with their child is strong enough so that they can confide in you, as well as you, as a parent, be able to tell them about possible maybe red flags or warning signs about a partner that their child is pursuing or with?
Yeah, I how you frame that question is really important because it shows that there's a lot at stake in the communication we establish with teens about romantic relationships. So the first thing I want to say is that it's very common for teens to not want to talk about their personal lives with their parents. So if you're listening to this and you are one of these parents who's like, man, I really want to know, but she, he, they are not talking to me about it, don't worry, because this is incredibly common. And I think what I discovered in my research is the best way to deal with that is just to continue to indicate your interest in this subject overall. That if you're watching something on TV or in a movie that concerns love and relationships, that you can philosophize about it, reflect on it, invite the teen in your life in on this conversation. And maybe it will be easier to get at issues when it's about the people on the screen as opposed to when it's about the teen. But there are also things that you can do to stir up these conversations, whether you've got a talkative teen or not. One is, if possible, start the conversations before the child is a teen. I used to really have a good time with my daughter when she was very small, talking about Disney movies and, you know, how Snow White opened doors for strangers and why did she do that? And what's up with this, like losing your voice for the man you love in the way that Ariel did in The Little Mermaid. And so conversations like that can be incredibly rich and set that stage for, you know, just the way some families talk about sports. Mom and dad are really interested in love and relationships and power and gender and keeping yourself safe and all these things. So if they know mom and dad are really interested, or mom and mom, or dad and dad, no matter who it is, that they know they can come to you, which is so valuable, even if they don't come to you a lot. And even if you're wondering about the long silences, because you know, it's the offer's out there. They know that they can come. And this becomes incredibly important when you're dealing with the very real risk of something like dating abuse, which one out of three teens experiences on some level. And if you have an openness already established, then again, you establish yourself as a kind of safe harbor, which is incredibly important when things don't go well.
I feel the topic of consent and boundaries has heightened in recent years, especially we as a society and younger generations publicly talking about it, at least. I think of the Me Too movement. So how does the younger generations navigate this? Do you have an example?
Wow, I do have an example. I mean, first of all, I want to say that there's this real paradox, right? Because we have Me Too, and then we have a Netflix show like Adolescence, which spotlights the very insidious influence of toxic masculinity and the belief system around that on very young boys and girls. And so this is the moment we live in, right? So what this means is that we, especially if we have daughters, quite frankly, in some ways, young people are going to be incredibly tuned in to issues of consent. But you don't ever want that to be like, oh, great, they already know about this stuff. We don't have to talk about this stuff, because you really do. Because along with that awareness and that sense of injustice that young people are very good at spotting, they also do have that pressure of the whole other side of the messaging, which is porn, toxic masculinity, Andrew Tate, that whole palette of yuck, frankly. So I think along with this, it is really important for parents to stay aware of where they came from. And the very difficult way that this entered my life was that when my daughter was 14, she had a friend who was sexually assaulted by another friend. And she showed me the text messages from this girl that described what had happened. And my first thought reading the description actually was not this girl was sexually assaulted, even though it was very clear what was happening. Like, he touched me in these places. I told him not to. And all I could think was, oh my God, you know, they're so young. It's just a misunderstanding. And it wasn't that I dismissed it. I just didn't frame it in those ways. And the next day she told me that the girl and her mother had gone to the police about it. And that was this real reckoning of like, oh my God, you know, the police, why did they go to the police? And then immediately realizing it's like they went to the police because this girl was violated. And I felt a lot of shame. I mean, when I worked for WAMC, I won an award for reporting on issues of sexual assault and domestic violence. I've been involved in some way in these issues most of my adult life. Yet I also grew up in a home where I had a close family member, my father, say, boys will be boys, and other versions of that phrase. So as a parent, I was sort of unwittingly navigating these two sets of messages, the intellectual and journalistic awareness versus the older messages about how boys and girls are together, which essentialized, you know, boys' sexual aggression. And the reason I shared this story, as painful as it was, and I did it with the full permission of my daughter and the girl who was involved, of course, without naming names, was because I wanted to sort of put out that call of like, we're going through some stuff too as parents, and we have to do gut checks around this stuff, because we'll push things away without realizing it because of how we grew up. So hopefully this will inspire other parents to sort of check in with those messages and see the situations their children go through more clearly.
We are talking to Lisa A. Phillips, the author of First Love, Guiding Teens Through Relationships and Heartbreak. You place a high importance on how mental health and teen relationships are very closely connected. Something that really struck me in the book was this line, which is right in the beginning. Every teen relationship story is also a mental health story. And I think that hits it right on the nose. So can you elaborate on this? I feel whether teens experience all forms of love or none at all, it does impact their mental health.
Yeah, you know, that expression came from the fact that I did more than 100 interviews with young people and parents for this book. And what I realized kind of early on in the project was that all the relationship stories I was hearing involved in some way about of depression on behalf of one or both of the partners, anxiety, addiction, eating disorders, all kinds of mental health issues. And at first I thought, like, I have to change the way I find people because I need some, quote, normal couples. And then I started to, you know, reflect on my own past experiences and also just, again, the nature of this generation being very mental health literate. And I kind of soon abandoned that idea and just sort of thought to myself, well, this is the reality. This is the reality. When young people go through relationships, they also go through mental health challenges. And so what began to interest me was how these young couples navigated this, as, you know, whether they were the person who was dealing with the mental health issue or the, what I call the caretaker role. I wanted to really illuminate that dynamic so that parents could be aware of a number of issues that arise around mental health issues and relationships. And I found out some really important things about the fact that, you know, in adolescence, relationships and mental health issues kind of spark each other. Later in life, healthy relationships are linked to better mental health. But in adolescence, all the kind of roller coaster ride of the feelings and so forth, which are very natural at that point in time, get exacerbated by relationships and vice versa. It doesn't mean relationships cause mental health problems or mental health problems cause relationships. It means the two things are happening at the same time. So there's a lot of interaction.
Breakups. Your last chapter delves into this. So how should parents navigate this as their child tries to as well?
Breakups are tough, and parents have a tough job, which is watching their child suffer. So there are a few gems of wisdom that I can offer to the parent whose child is going through heartbreak. And for many young people, this is their first real experience of grief and loss. First of all is to, especially when it first happens, to really validate what they're going through, to validate that this is real pain, like literally in your cells, it's real pain. And that, I think, goes a long way. Often as parents, our impulse is to try to shrink the pain. And really what many experts told me is that validation is so important. You don't just say, oh, you'll go on, love other people. You really validate the young person for where they're at. And then there were a few kind of concrete tips that I really love to share. One is simply that when they're in that position of heartbreak, it obviously can be very obsessive and preoccupying. So an important thing to do once you move through the validation phase is to work with the young person in your life to solve some concrete problems, such as I left my hoodie at my girlfriend's house. You know, how do I get it back? Those kinds of problems can obsess you when you're distraught over a breakup. But there's a real role for a parent. Just be like, okay, let's set up a time. Let's do this thing. You know, here's how we're going to do it. And or make suggestions for how we're going to do it. And these little things can help young people feel a real sense of power.
What would be the lessons or advice that you would give parents regarding their children love? If you could only give a couple, there's so much in your book, but if you were only to give a couple, what would they be?
Okay, so I think that the first thing that comes to mind in your question is if your child is in an ambiguous relationship, the common term is situationship. You may hear friends with benefits. I've heard the term textuationship recently, which I think is kind of perfect. That if your child happens to be someone who's the person who wants more out of the relationship, that it's really important to help to valorize that position. Obviously, if they want something the other person doesn't want, they have to cope with that and figure out how to respond. And there's often a lot of shame around that. And what I say to young people, my daughter, my college students, is to feel proud that you have this big and loving heart. And not feel like you're the loser because you're the person who cares more. It's natural to catch feelings when you're having sex with someone, when you're spending time with someone. And it's fine to say, no, I don't want to go there. But if you happen to be the person who caught the feelings, you know, give yourself some credit for having a beating and beautiful heart. And then figure out how you're going to deal with the situation. But shame isn't going to help you deal with it better, or embarrassment.
The name of the book is First Love, Guiding Teens Through Relationships and Heartbreak. It is published by Roman and Littlefield. Lisa, thank you so much for speaking with me this morning and providing your insights.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was a pleasure. Again, the name of the book is First Love, Guiding Teens Through Relationships and Heartbreak. You have been listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.